heard. And for the speaker, it's indescribably satisfying to receive such powerful recognition. One of the more awkward moments we've ever had at TED was when a speaker left the stage to lukewarm applause and whispered to her friend backstage, "Nobody stood up." An understandable comment. It was just unfortunate that her microphone was still on and everyone could hear the pain in her voice. Whether they admit it or not, many public speakers dream of being cheered as they leave the stage, followed by screens full of tweets attesting to their inspirational prowess. And therein lies the trap. The intense appeal of the standing ovation can lead aspiring speakers to do bad things. They may look at talks given by inspirational speakers and seek to copy them, but in form only. The result can be awful. The ruthless pursuit of every trick in the book to intellectually and emotionally manipulate the audience. There was an upsetting instance of this at TED a few years ago. To be kind, I've changed a couple of details. An American man in his 40s had become a huge TED fan, and he sent us a compelling audition video urging us to let him give his own talk. His talk premise exactly matched the theme we were focused on that year, and he came well recommended, so we decided to give him a shot. The first moments of his talk were promising. He had a big personality, he beamed at the audience, he had some amusing opening remarks, a clever video, and a surprising visual prop. It was as if he'd studied every TED talk in detail and was bringing the best of each to his own talk. Sitting and watching, I was hopeful we might have a giant hit on our hands. But then I started to feel a little queasy. There was something not quite right. He was loving being on stage, loving it just a little too much. He'd keep pausing, hoping for audience applause or laughter, and when he got it, he'd stop and say, "Thank you," subtly milking it for more. He started inserting ad-lib comments intended to amuse. It was clear they amused him, but others, not so much. And the worst of it was the promised substance of the talk never really arrived. He claimed to have worked on demonstrating the truth of an important idea, but the case he brought was all whimsy and anecdote. There was one moment where he had even photoshopped an image so that it appeared to support his case. And because of his getting carried away and soaking up the limelight, he was running way over time. Toward the end, he began telling people that, yes, they had it in their power to adopt his wisdom, and he spoke of dreams and inspiration, ending with his arms outstretched to the audience. Because it was clear that the talk meant so much to him, a portion of the audience did indeed stand to clap him. Me? I felt sick to my stomach. This was the cliché of TED that we'd tried so hard to eliminate. All style, very little substance. The trouble with talks like this is not just that they flatter to deceive. It's that they give the entire genre a bad name. They make the audience less likely to open up when a genuinely inspiring speaker comes along. And yet, more and more speakers, attracted to the drug of audience adoration, are trying to walk this path. Please don't be one of them. Here's the thing about inspiration. It has to be earned. Someone is inspiring not because they look at you with big eyes and ask you to find it in your heart to believe in their dream. It's because they actually have a dream that's worth getting excited about. And those dreams don't come lightly. They come from blood, sweat, and tears. Inspiration is like love. You don't get it by pursuing it directly. In fact, there's a name for people who pursue love too directly. Stalker. In less extreme cases, the words we use are almost as bad. Cloying, inappropriate, desperate. And sadly, this behavior prompts the opposite of what it desires. It prompts a pulling back. It's the same with inspiration. If you try to take the shortcut and win people over purely with your charisma, you may succeed for a moment or two, but soon you'll be found out and the audience will flee. In the example above, despite the partial standing ovation, that speaker received terrible audience feedback in our post-conference survey, and we never posted the talk. People had felt manipulated, and they were. If you have dreams of being a rock star public speaker, pumping up an audience as you stride the stage and proclaim your brilliance, I beg you to reconsider. Don't dream of that. Dream of something much bigger than you are. Go and work on that dream as long as it takes to achieve something worthwhile, and then humbly come and share what you've learned. Inspiration can't be performed. It's an audience response to authenticity, courage, selfless work, and genuine wisdom. Bring those qualities to your talk and you may be amazed at what happens. It's easy to talk about why talks fail, but how can they be built to succeed? It all starts with a moment of clarity. 4. The through line. What's your point? It happens way too often. You're sitting there in the audience listening to someone talk, and you know that there is a better and great talk in that person. It's just not the talk he's giving. That's TED's Bruno Giussani again, a man who cannot stand seeing potentially great speakers blow their opportunity. The point of a talk is to say something meaningful. But it's amazing how many talks never quite do that. There are lots of spoken sentences, to be sure. But somehow they leave the audience with nothing they can hold on to. Beautiful slides and a charismatic stage presence are all very well, but if there's no real takeaway, all the speaker has done, at best, is to entertain. The number one reason for this tragedy is that the speaker never had a proper plan for the talk as a whole. The talk may have been planned bullet point by bullet point, or even sentence by sentence, but no time was actually spent on its overall arc. There's a helpful word used to analyze plays, movies, and novels. It applies to talks too. It is through line, the connecting theme that ties together each narrative element. Every talk should have one. Since your goal is to construct something wondrous inside your listeners' minds, you can think of the through line as a strong cord or rope onto which you will attach all the elements that are part of the idea you're building. This doesn't mean every talk can only cover one topic, tell a single story, or just proceed in one direction without diversions. Not at all. It just means that all the pieces need to connect. Here's the start of a talk thrown together without a through line. I want to share with you some experiences I had during my recent trip to Cape Town and then make a few observations about life on the road. Compare that with, on my recent trip to Cape Town, I learned something new about strangers, when you can trust them and when you definitely can't. Let me share with you two very different experiences I had. The first setup might work for your family, but the second, with its through line visible from the get-go, is far more enticing to a general audience. A good exercise is to try to encapsulate your through line in no more than 15 words. And those 15 words need to provide robust content. It's not enough to think of your goal as, I want to inspire the audience, or I want to win support for my work. It has to be more focused than that. What is the precise idea you want to build inside your listeners? What is their takeaway? It is also important not to have a through line that's too predictable or banal, such as the importance of hard work or the four main projects I've been working on. You can do better. Here are the through lines of some popular TED Talks. Notice that there's an unexpectedness incorporated into each of them. More choice actually makes us less happy. Vulnerability is something to be treasured, not hidden from. Education's potential is transformed if you focus on the amazing and hilarious creativity of kids. With body language, you can fake it till you become it. A History of the Universe in 18 minutes shows a path from chaos to order. Terrible city flags can reveal surprising design secrets. A ski trek to the South Pole threatened my life and overturned my sense of purpose. Let's bring on a quiet revolution, a world redesigned for introverts. The combination of three simple technologies creates a mind-blowing sixth sense. Online videos can humanize the classroom and revolutionize education. Barry Schwartz, whose talk is the first one in the list above, on the paradox of choice, is a big believer in the importance of a through line. Quote, many speakers have fallen in love with their ideas and find it hard to imagine what is complicated about them to people who are not already immersed. The key is to present just one idea as thoroughly and completely as you can in the limited time period. What is it that you want your audience to have an unambiguous understanding of after you're done? The last through line in the list above is from education reformer Salman Khan. He told me, "There were a lot of really interesting things that Khan Academy had done, but that felt too self-serving. I wanted to share ideas that are bigger, ideas like mastery-based learning and humanizing class time by removing lectures. My advice to speakers would be to look for a single big idea that is larger than you or your organization, but at the same time, to leverage your experience to show that it isn't just empty speculation." Your through line doesn't have to be as ambitious as those above, but it still should have some kind of intriguing angle. Instead of giving a talk about the importance of hard work, how about speaking on why hard work sometimes fails to achieve true success and what you can do about that? Instead of planning to speak about the four main projects you've recently been working on, how about structuring it around just three of the projects that happen to have a surprising connection? In fact, Robin Murphy had exactly that as her through line when she came to speak at TED Women. Here's the opening of her talk. "Robots are quickly becoming first responders at disaster sites, working alongside humans to aid recovery. The involvement of these sophisticated machines has the potential to transform disaster relief, saving lives and money. I'd like to share with you today three new robots I've worked on that demonstrate this." Not every talk has to state its throughline explicitly up front like this. As we'll see, there are many other ways to intrigue people and invite them to join you on your journey. But when the audience knows where you're headed, it's much easier for them to follow. Let's think once again of a talk as a journey that the speaker and the audience take together with the speaker as the guide. But if you, the speaker, want the audience to come with you, you probably need to give them a hint of where you're going. And then you need to be sure that each step of the journey helps get you there. In this journey metaphor, the through line traces the path that the journey takes. It ensures that there are no impossible leaps and that by the end of the talk, the speaker and audience have arrived together at a satisfying destination. Many people approach a talk thinking they will just outline their work or describe their organization or explore an issue. That's not a great plan. The talk is likely to end up unfocused and without much impact. Bear in mind that a through line is not the same thing as a topic. Your invitation might seem super clear. "Dear Mary, we want you to come talk about that new desalination technology you developed." "Dear John, could you come and tell us the story of your kayaking adventure in Kazakhstan?" But even when the topic is clear, the through line is worth thinking about. A talk about kayaking could have a through line based on endurance or group dynamics or the dangers of turbulent river eddies. The desalination talk might have a through line based on disruptive innovation, or the global water crisis, or the awesomeness of engineering elegance. So, how do you figure out your through line? The first step is to find out as much as you can about the audience. Who are they? How knowledgeable are they? What are their expectations? What do they care about? What have past speakers there spoken about? You can only gift an idea to minds that are ready to receive that type of idea. If you're going to speak to an audience of taxi drivers in London about the amazingness of a digitally powered sharing economy, it would be helpful to know in advance that their livelihood is being destroyed by Uber. But the biggest obstacle in identifying a through line is expressed in every speaker's primal scream. "I have far too much to say and not enough time to say it." We hear this one a lot. TED Talks have a maximum time limit of 18 minutes. Why 18? It's short enough to hold people's attention, including on the internet, and precise enough to be taken seriously. But it's also long enough to say something that matters. Yet, most speakers are used to talking for 30 to 40 minutes or longer. They find it really hard to imagine giving a proper talk in such a short period of time. It's certainly not the case that a short talk means shorter preparation time. President Woodrow Wilson was once asked about how long it took him to prepare for a speech. He replied, "That depends on the length of the speech. If it is a 10-minute speech, it takes me all of 2 weeks to prepare it. If it is a half-hour speech, it takes me a week. If I can talk as long as I want to, it requires no preparation at all. I am ready now." It reminds me of the famous quote attributed to a variety of great thinkers and writers, "If I had more time, I would have written a shorter letter." So, let's accept that creating a great talk to fit a limited time period is going to take real effort. but there's a right way and a wrong way to go about it. The wrong way. The wrong way to condense your talk is to include all the things that you think you need to say and simply cut them all back to make them a lot shorter. Funnily enough, you may well be able to create a script that achieves this. Every major topic you want to cover is there in summary form. Your work is covered. You may even think there's a through line connecting it all, some broad underpinning of your work. To you, it may feel like you've given it your all and done the best you can to fit the time you've been given to speak. But through lines that connect large numbers of concepts don't work. There's a drastic consequence when you rush through multiple topics in summary form. They don't land with any force. You know the full background and context to what you're saying, and so the insights you offer may seem profound to you, but for the audience which is coming to your work fresh, the talk will probably come across as conceptual, dry, or superficial. It's a simple equation. Overstuffed equals underexplained. To say something interesting, you have to take the time to do at least two things. Show why it matters. What's the question you're trying to answer, the problem you're trying to solve, the experience you're trying to share? Flesh out each point you make with real examples, stories, facts. This is how ideas that you cherish can be built in someone else's mind. The trouble is that explaining the why and then giving the examples take time, and that leaves you with just one choice. The right way. To provide an effective talk, you must slash back the range of topics you will cover to a single connected thread, a through line that can be properly developed. In a sense, you cover less, but the impact will actually be significantly greater. Author Richard Bach said, "Great writing is all about the power of the deleted word." It's true of speaking too. The secret of successful talks often lies in what is left out. Less can be more. Many TED speakers have told us that this has been the key to getting their talk right. Here's musician Amanda Palmer. "I found my ego really trapping me. If my TED talk goes viral, I need people to know what a great pianist I am, that I can also paint, that I write fantastic lyrics, that I have all these other talents. This is my chance. But no, the only way the talk can truly soar is if you take your ego out of it and let yourself be a delivery vehicle for the ideas themselves. I remember going to dinner with TED regular Nicholas Negroponte and asked if he had any advice for my talk. He said something that my Buddhist-leaning mentor had been saying for years, leave space and say less. Economist Nick Marks recommends the advice often given to fledgling writers, kill your darlings. I had to be prepared to not talk about some things I absolutely love and would have liked to squeeze in, but they were not part of the main narrative. That was tough but essential. One of the most popular TED speakers, Brené Brown, also struggled to meet TED's tight time demands. She recommends this simple formula. Plan your talk, then cut it by half. Once you've grieved the loss of half of your talk, cut it another 50%. It's seductive to think about how much you can fit into 18 minutes. The better question for me is, what can you unpack in a meaningful way in 18 minutes? This same issue applies to talks of any length. Let me try a personal example with you. Let's say I've been asked to speak for just 2 minutes to introduce who I am. Here's version one. Although I'm British, I was born in Pakistan. My father was a missionary eye surgeon, and my early years were spent there and in India and Afghanistan. At age 13, I was sent to boarding school in England, and after that I went to Oxford University for a degree in philosophy, politics, and economics. I started work as a local newspaper journalist in Wales, then moved to a pirate radio station in the Seychelles Islands for a couple of years to write and read a world news service. Back in the UK in the mid-1980s, I fell in love with computers and started a series of magazines devoted to them. It was a great time to be launching specialist magazines, and my company doubled in size every year for 7 years. I sold it, moved to the US, and tried again. By the year 2000, my business had grown to 2,000 employees and 150 magazines and websites. But the tech bubble was about to burst, and when it did, it nearly destroyed the company. Besides, who needs magazines when you have the internet? I left at the end of 2001. Happily, I had put some money into a non-profit foundation that I was able to use to buy TED, which back then was an annual conference in California. That's been my full-time passion ever since. And here's version two. I want you to come with me to a student's room at Oxford University in 1977. You open the door, and at first it seems like there's nobody there. But wait. Over in the corner, there's a boy lying on the floor, face up, staring at the ceiling. He's been like that for more than 90 minutes. That's me. 20-year-old me. I am thinking. Hard. I am trying... Please don't laugh. I am trying to solve the problem of free will. That deep mystery that has stumped the world's philosophers for at least 2 millennia? Yep. I'm taking it on. Anyone looking objectively at the scene would have concluded that this boy was some weird combination of arrogant, deluded, or perhaps just socially awkward and lonely, preferring the company of ideas to people. But my own narrative? I'm a dreamer. I've always been obsessed by the power of ideas, and I'm pretty sure it's that inward focus that helped me survive growing up in boarding schools in India and England, away from my missionary parents, and that gave me the confidence to try to build a media company. Certainly, it was the dreamer in me that fell in love so deeply with TED. Most recently, I've been dreaming about the revolution in public speaking and what it could lead to. So, which version tells you more about me? The first one certainly has far more facts. It's a decent summary of big parts of my life, a 2-minute resume. The second one focuses on just a single moment of my life. And yet, when I try this experiment on people, they say they find the second far more interesting and also far more revealing. Whether your time limit is 2 minutes, 18 minutes, or an hour, let's agree to this as a starting point. You will only cover as much ground as you can dive into in sufficient depth to be compelling. And this is where the concept of a through line really helps. By choosing a through line, you will automatically filter out much of what you might otherwise say. When I did the above experiment, I thought, what aspect of me should I focus on for a little more depth? The decision to go with Dreamer made it easy to anchor version 2 on my time studying philosophy at Oxford and slash back most of the other parts of my life. If I had chosen entrepreneur or nerd or global soul, I'd have made different cuts. So, a through line requires you first to identify an idea that can be properly unpacked in the time you have available. You should then build a structure so that every element in your talk is somehow linked to this idea. Let's pause for a moment on that word structure. It's critical. Different talks can have very different structures tied onto that central through line. A talk might begin with an introduction to the problem the speaker is tackling and give an anecdote that illustrates that problem. It might then move to some historical attempts to solve the problem and give 2 examples that ultimately failed. It could continue to the speaker's proposed solution, including 1 dramatic new piece of evidence that supports the idea. Then it might close with 3 implications for the future. You can picture the structure of that talk as like a tree. There's a central through line rising vertically with branches attached to it, each of which represents an expansion of the main narrative, 1 at the bottom for the opening anecdote, 2 just above that at the history section for the examples that failed, 1 at the proposed solution to mark the new evidence, and 3 at the top to illustrate the implications for the future. Another talk might be simply sharing, 1 after the other, 5 pieces of work that have a connected theme, beginning and ending with the speaker's current project. In that structure, you can think of the through line as a loop that connects 5 different boxes, each representing 1 of the pieces of work. The most viewed TED speaker at the time of writing this book is Sir Ken Robinson. He told me that most of his talks follow this simple structure. A. Introduction, getting settled, what will be covered. B. Context, why this issue matters. C. Main concepts. D. Practical implications. E. Conclusion. He said, there's an old formula for writing essays that says a good essay answers 3 questions. What? So what? Now what? It's a bit like that. Of course, the appeal of Sir Ken's talks goes way beyond their structural simplicity, and neither he nor I would recommend everyone adopt that same structure. What matters is that you find the structure that most powerfully develops your through line in the time available, and that it is clear how each talk element ties into it. Your through line needs handling with special care if you have to speak on a heavy subject. The horror of a refugee crisis, the diabetes explosion, gender-related violence in South America. Many speakers on these topics view their job as to highlight a cause that needs to be more widely known. The structure of these talks is typically to lay out a series of facts that illustrate how awful a situation is and why something must be done to fix it. And indeed, there are times when that is the perfect way to frame a talk, provided you're confident that your listeners are ready and willing to be made to feel uncomfortable. The trouble is, if an audience sits through too many talks like this, it will get emotionally exhausted and will start to switch off. Compassion fatigue sets in. If that happens before your talk is done, you'll have no impact. How can you root around that? The first step is to think of your talk not as being about an issue, but about an idea. My former colleague June Cohen framed the difference this way. An issue-based talk leads with morality. An idea-based talk leads with curiosity. An issue exposes a problem. An idea proposes a solution. An issue says, "Isn't this terrible?" An idea says, "Isn't this interesting?" It's much easier to pull in an audience by framing the talk as an attempt to solve an intriguing riddle rather than as a plea for them to care. The first feels like a gift being offered. The second feels like an ask. As you work on developing your throughline, here's a simple checklist. Is this a topic I'm passionate about? Does it inspire curiosity? Will it make a difference to the audience to have this knowledge? Is my talk a gift or an ask? Is the information fresh or is it already out there? Can I truly explain the topic in the time slot allocated, complete with necessary examples? Do I know enough about this to make a talk worth the audience's time? Do I have the credibility to take on this topic? What are the 15 words that encapsulate my talk? Would those 15 words persuade someone they'd be interested in hearing my talk? Speaking coach Abigail Tenenbaum recommends testing your throughline on someone who could be a typical audience member, and to do so not in writing, but verbally. Saying it out loud often crystallizes for the speaker what is clear, what is missing, and how to sharpen it. Best-selling author Elizabeth Gilbert also believes in planning a talk for an audience of one. She offered me this advice. Choose a human being, an actual human being in your life, and prepare your talk as if you will be delivering it to that one person only. Choose someone who is not in your field, but who is generally an intelligent, curious, engaged, worldly person, and someone whom you really like. This will bring a warmth of spirit and heart to your talk. Most of all, be sure you are actually speaking to one person and not to a demographic. My speech is for people in the software field who are between the ages of 22 and 38. Because a demographic is not a human being. And if you speak to a demographic, you will not sound like you are speaking to a human being. You don't have to go to their house and practice your talk on them for 6 months. They don't even need to know that you're doing this. Just choose your one ideal listener and then do your best to create a talk that would blow their mind or move them or fascinate them or delight them. But most important of all, says Gilbert, is to pick a topic that lives deep within you. Quote, talk about what you know. Talk about what you know and love with all your heart. I want to hear about the subject that is most important to your life, not some random subject that you think will be a novelty. Bring me your well-worn passion of decades, not some fresh, radical gimmick. And trust me, I will be captivated. Once you have your through line, you're ready to plan what you'll attach to it. There are many ways to build ideas. Over the next 5 chapters, we'll look at 5 core tools that speakers use. Connection, narration, explanation, persuasion, revelation. They can be mixed and matched. Some talks stick to a single tool, others incorporate multiple elements. A few use all 5, and often approximately in the order above. But it's worth looking at them separately because the 5 techniques are strikingly different. Talk tools. 5. Connection. Get personal. Knowledge can't be pushed into a brain. It has to be pulled in. Before you can build an idea in someone else's mind, you need their permission. People are naturally cautious about opening up their minds, the most precious thing they own, to complete strangers. You need to find a way to overcome that caution. And the way you do that is to make visible the human being cowering inside you. Hearing a talk is a completely different thing from reading an essay. It's not just the words, not at all. It's the person delivering the words. To make an impact, there has to be a human connection. You can give the most brilliant talk with crystal clear explanations and laser sharp logic, but if you don't first connect with the audience, it just won't land. Even if the content is, at some level, understood, it won't be activated, but simply filed away in some soon-to-be-forgotten mental archive. People aren't computers. They're social creatures with all manner of ingenious quirks. They have evolved weapons to protect against dangerous knowledge polluting the worldview they depend on. Those weapons have names. Skepticism, mistrust, dislike, boredom, incomprehension. And by the way, those weapons are invaluable. If your mind were open to all incoming language, your life would quickly fall apart. Coffee gives you cancer. Those foreigners are disgusting. Buy these beautiful kitchen knives. I know how to give you a good time, baby. Every single thing we see or hear is evaluated before we dare embed it into an actionable idea. So your very first job as a speaker is to find a way to disarm those weapons and build a trusting human bond with the audience so that they're willing, delighted even, to offer you full access to their minds for a few minutes. If military metaphors aren't to your liking, let's go back to the idea of a talk as a journey. It is a journey you take your audience on. You may have figured out a brilliant route to a powerful destination, but before you can take people there, you have to make the journey seem enticing. Task one is to go where the audience is and win them over. Yes, you're a guide who can be trusted. Without that, the whole endeavor may bog down before it has even started. We tell our speakers that TED offers a warm, welcoming audience, but even so, there's a huge difference in impact between those speakers who connect and those who unconsciously trigger skepticism or boredom or dislike. Happily, there are numerous ways to make that vital early connection. Here are five suggestions. Make eye contact right from the start. Humans are good at forming instant judgments about other humans. Friend or foe, likable or unlikable, wise or dull, confident or tentative. The clues we use to make these sweeping judgments are often shockingly light. The way someone dresses, how they walk or stand, their facial expression, their body language, their attentiveness. Great speakers find a way of making an early connection with their audience. It can be as simple as walking confidently on stage, looking round, making eye contact with two or three people, and smiling. Take a look at the first few moments of Kelly McGonigal's TED Talk on the upside of stress. Quote, I have a confession to make. She pauses, turns, drops hands, gives a little smile. But first, I want you to make a little confession to me. Walks forward. In the past year, looks around intently from face to face. I want you to just raise your hand if you've experienced relatively little stress. Anyone? An enigmatic smile, which a few moments later turns into a million-dollar smile. There is instant audience connection there. Now, not all of us are as naturally fluent, relaxed, or beautiful as Kelly. But one thing we can all do is make eye contact with audience members and smile a little. It makes a huge difference. The Indian artist Raghava KK maintains great eye contact, as does Argentine democracy advocate Pia Mancini. Within seconds of them starting, you just feel yourself being reeled in. There's a reason for this. Humans have evolved a sophisticated ability to read other people by looking at their eyes. We can subconsciously detect the tiniest movement of eye muscles in someone's face and use it to judge not just how they are feeling, but whether we can trust them. And while we're doing that, they're doing the same to us. Scientists have shown that just the act of two people staring at each other will trigger mirror neuron activity that literally adopts the emotional state of the other person. If I'm beaming, I will make you smile inside, just a bit. But a meaningful bit. If I'm nervous, you'll feel a little anxious too. We look at each other and our minds sync. And the extent to which our minds sync is determined in part by how much we instinctively trust each other. the best tool to engender that trust? Yep, a smile. A natural human smile. People can detect fake smiles and immediately feel manipulated. Ron Gutman gave a TED Talk on the hidden power of smiles. It's well worth 7.5 minutes of your time. Eye contact, backed by an occasional warm smile, is an amazing technology that can transform how a talk is received. It's a shame, though, that it's sometimes undermined by another technology, stage lighting. Some lighting setups mean a speaker is dazzled by bright spotlights and can't even see the audience. Talk to the event organizer about this ahead of time. If you're on stage and feeling disconnected, it's okay to ask for the house lights to be raised or the stage lights dimmed a little. At TED, our number one advice to speakers on the day of their talk is to make regular eye contact with members of the audience. Be warm, be real, be you. It opens the door to them trusting you, liking you, and beginning to share your passion. When you walk onto the stage, you should be thinking about one thing, your true excitement at the chance to share your passion with the people sitting right there a few feet from you. Don't rush in with your opening sentence, walk into the light, pick out a couple of people, look them in the eye, nod a greeting, and smile. Then you're on your way. Show vulnerability. One of the best ways to disarm an audience is to first reveal your own vulnerability. It's the equivalent of the tough cowboy walking into a saloon and holding his coat wide open to reveal no weapons. Everyone relaxes. Brené Brown gave a wonderful talk on vulnerability at TEDx Houston, and she began it appropriately. A couple years ago, an event planner called me because I was going to do a speaking event, and she said, "I'm really struggling with how to write about you on the little flyer." And I thought, "Well, what's the struggle?" And she said, "Well, I saw you speak, and I'm going to call you a researcher, I think. But I'm afraid if I call you a researcher, no one will come because they'll think you're boring and irrelevant." You love her already. By the same logic, if you're feeling nervous, it can actually work in your favor. Audiences sense it instantly, and far from despising you as you may fear, the opposite happens. They begin rooting for you. We often encourage speakers who look like they may struggle with nerves to simply be ready, if necessary, to acknowledge it. If you feel yourself choking up, then pause, pick up a bottle of water, take a sip, and just say what you're feeling. "Hang in there a moment. As you can see, I'm feeling a little nervous here. Normal service will be restored soon." Likely as not, you'll get a warm round of applause and a crowd dying for you to succeed. Vulnerability can be powerful at any stage of a talk. One of the most stunning moments witnessed on the TED stage came when neurosurgeon and best-selling author Shoin Newland had just completed a tour de force history of electroshock therapy, the treatment for severe mental illness that involves sending electric current directly through a patient's brain. He was knowledgeable and funny, and he made it all seem interesting and a little terrifying, but then he stopped. "Why am I telling you this story at this meeting?" He said he wanted to share something he'd never spoken or written about before. You could have heard a pin drop. "The reason is that I am a man who almost 30 years ago had his life saved by 2 long courses of electroshock therapy." Newland went on to unveil his own secret history of debilitating depression, an illness that got so bad doctors were planning to remove part of his brain. Instead, as a last resort, they tried electroshock therapy, and eventually, after 20 treatments, it had worked. By making himself so deeply vulnerable to the audience, he was able to end his talk with extraordinary power. "I've always felt that somehow I was an imposter because my readers don't know what I have just told you. So one of the reasons that I have come here to talk about this today is to, frankly, selfishly, unburden myself and let it be known that this is not an untroubled mind that has written all of these books. But more importantly, I think, is the fact that a very significant proportion of people in this audience are under 30, and it looks to me like almost all of you are on the cusp of a magnificent and exciting career. Anything can happen to you. Things change. Accidents happen. Something from childhood comes back to haunt you. You can be thrown off the track. If I can find my way back from this, believe me, anybody can find their way back from any adversity that exists in their lives. And for those who are older, who have lived through difficult times, perhaps where they lost everything, as I did, and started out all over again, some of these things will seem very familiar. There is recovery, there is redemption, and there is resurrection. This is a talk everyone should see. Sherwin Newland passed away in 2014, but his vulnerability and consequent inspiration live on. Willing to be vulnerable is one of the most powerful tools a speaker can wield, but as with anything powerful, it should be handled with care. Brené Brown has seen a lot of speakers misinterpret her advice. She told me, "Formulaic or contrived personal sharing leaves audiences feeling manipulated and often hostile towards you and your message. Vulnerability is not oversharing. There's a simple equation. Vulnerability minus boundaries is not vulnerability. It can be anything from an attempt to hotwire connection to attention seeking, but it's not vulnerability, and it doesn't lead to connection. The best way I've found to get clear on this is to really examine our intentions. Is sharing done in service of the work on stage, or is it a way to work through our own stuff? The former is powerful, the latter damages the confidence people have in us. Brown strongly recommends that you don't share parts of yourself that you haven't yet worked through. Quote, "We need to have owned our stories before sharing them is experienced as a gift. A story is only ready to share when the presenter's healing and growth is not dependent on the audience's response to it. Authentic vulnerability is powerful, oversharing is not. If in doubt, try your talk on an honest friend." Make them laugh, but not squirm. Concentrating on a talk can be hard work, and humor is a wonderful way to bring the audience with you. If Sophie Scott is right, part of the evolutionary purpose of laughter is to create social bonding. When you laugh with someone, you both feel you're on the same side. It's a fantastic tool for building a connection. Indeed, for many great speakers, humor has become a super weapon. Sir Ken Robinson's talk on school's failure to nurture creativity, which as of 2015 had powered its way to 35 million views on TED, was given on the final day of the conference. He started like this. "It's been great, hasn't it? I've been blown away. In fact, I'm leaving." The audience giggled and basically never stopped. From that moment, he owned us. Humor hacks away the main resistance to listening to a talk. By offering little gifts of laughter from the start, you are subtly informing your audience, "Come along for the ride, dear friends. It's going to be a treat." Audiences who laugh with you quickly come to like you. And if people like you, they're much readier to take seriously what you have to say. Laughter blows open someone's defenses, and suddenly you have a chance to truly communicate with them. There's another big benefit of laughter early in a talk. It's a powerful signal that you're connecting. Monica Lewinsky told me that the moment her nervousness went away during her TED talk was when the audience erupted with laughter. And if it's a signal to the speaker, it's also a signal to everyone else in the room. Laughter says, "We as a group have bonded with this speaker." Everyone then pays more attention. It's striking that some of the very best speakers spend a significant portion of their talks building this connection. In Sir Ken's case above, almost all of the first 11 minutes is a series of hilarious, education-related stories that do little to advance his main idea, but instead create an extraordinary bond with the audience. We're thinking, this is so much fun. I never thought education could be such an engaging topic. You are such an appealing person, I'd go with you anywhere. And when he eventually gets serious and moves into his main point about the loss of creativity in schools, we're hanging on every word. Likewise, in Brian Stevenson's spellbinding talk about injustice, he spent the first quarter of his time on a single story about how his grandmother had persuaded him never to drink. The story ends hilariously, and suddenly we all felt deeply connected to this man. Caution. Successfully spending that much time on humorous stories is a special gift, not recommended for most of us. But if you can find just one short story that makes people smile, it may unlock the rest of your talk. Comic sci-fi author Rob Reed offered a very different type of humor, satire. His tone throughout was serious. You claim to be offering a sober analysis of copyright math. But after a minute or so, people began realizing that actually he was mocking the absurdity of copyright laws that regarded every illegally downloaded song as the equivalent of stealing $150,000. The giggles started and quickly flared into guffaws. Of course, it doesn't always work. One speaker at TED a few years ago clearly thought he was being hilarious in telling a series of ever more awkward stories about his ex-wife. Maybe a couple of friends in the audience were chuckling. The rest of us were cringing. On another occasion, a speaker tried to perform every quotation in his talk in the accent he imagined the author of the quote might have had. Perhaps his family found this to be endearing. On a public stage, it was just embarrassing. Unless you're extremely talented, I strongly recommend avoiding accents other than your own. 30 years ago, speakers packed their talks with jokes based on gender, race, and disability. Don't go there. The world has changed. Humor is a skilled art, and not everyone can do it. Ineffective humor is worse than no humor at all. Telling a joke that you downloaded off the internet will probably backfire. Indeed, jokes per se seem hackneyed, clumsy, and unsophisticated. What you're looking for instead are hilarious but true stories that are directly relevant to your topic or are an endearing, humorous use of language. The funniest person on our team is Tom Riley, who runs our Fellows program, and for years gave a final wrap-up of the conference that skewered every speaker with wicked hilarity. Here's his advice.
1. Tell anecdotes relevant to your subject matter, where humor is natural. The best humor is based on observation of things occurring around you and then exaggerating or remixing them. 2. Have a funny remark ready if you flub your words, the AV goes awry, or if the clicker doesn't work. The audience has been there, and you instantly win their sympathy. 3. Build humor into your visuals. You can also have the humor be the contrast between what you're saying and what you're showing. There are lots of great possibilities for laughter. 4. Use satire, saying the opposite of what you mean, and then revealing your intent, though this is really hard to get right. 5. Timing is critical. If there's a laughter moment, you have to give it a chance to land. That may take the courage to pause just for a moment, and to do so without looking like you're fishing for applause. 6. Very important. If you're not funny, don't try to be funny. Test the humor on family or friends or even a colleague. Are they laughing? If not, change it or spike it. Dangers, even in the hands of people blessed with the gift of humor. 1. Off-color remarks and offensive language. Don't. You're not speaking at a late-night comedy club. 2. Limericks or other seemingly funny poetry. 3. Puns. 4. Sarcasm. 5. Going on too long. 6. Any attempted humor based on religion, ethnicity, gender, gender identity, sexual orientation, or politics. Members of those communities maybe can. Outsiders definitely can't.
All of these can work in the right circumstances, but are fraught with the possibility of bombing or causing offense. If the audience experiences either, it's hard to get them back. If you plan to do a lot of public speaking, it's really worth trying to find your own brand of humor that works. And if not, don't panic. It's not for everyone. There are plenty of other ways to connect. Park your ego. Would you want to trust your mind to someone who is completely full of himself? Nothing damages the prospects of a talk more than the sense that the speaker is a blowhard. And if that happens early on, look out. I vividly remember a TED talk from many years ago that began, "Before I became a living brand," and there, right there, you knew it wasn't going to end well. The speaker was on a high after some recent major commercial success, and we were going to hear about every last bit of it. That's the only time at TED I remember a talk being interrupted by hisses. Hisses! Even if you truly are a genius, a drop-dead gorgeous athlete, and a fearless leader, it's best to let your audience figure that out for themselves. TED speaker Salman Khan put it beautifully. Be yourself. The worst talks are the ones where someone is trying to be someone they aren't. If you are generally goofy, then be goofy. If you are emotional, then be emotional. The one exception to that is if you are arrogant and self-centered, then you should definitely pretend to be someone else. Some speakers use humor to land a deliberate blow to their egos. Dan Pink, an accomplished speaker whose talk on motivation has 10 million views and counting, walked onto the stage looking just a bit overconfident and began speaking in a voice that was just a tad too loud. But after his first few sentences, we were all in his pocket. This is what he said. I need to make a confession at the outset here. A little over 20 years ago, I did something that I regret, something that I'm not particularly proud of, something that in many ways I wish no one would ever know, but here I feel kind of obliged to reveal. In the late 1980s, in a moment of youthful indiscretion, I went to law school. Brilliant. Now we liked him after all. Self-deprecation in the right hands is a beautiful thing. Tony Blair is a master at it, often using self-deprecation to win over potentially hostile audiences. Once, before he was elected British Prime Minister, he began to tell a story which he said, apologetically, might make people worry whether he was qualified to govern. He told of a visit to the Netherlands, where, at a meal with dignitaries, he encountered a well-dressed woman in her 50s. She asked him who he was. Tony Blair. And what do you do? I lead the British Labour Party. He asked her who she was. Beatrice. And what do you do? Awkward pause. I'm the Queen. Another speaker would have just name-dropped that he'd had dinner with the Queen of the Netherlands and lost the audience before he started. By deliberately talking himself down, Blair won laughter, affection, and trust. Ego emerges in lots of ways that may be truly invisible to a speaker who's used to being the center of attention. Name-dropping, stories that seem designed only to show off, boasting about your or your company's achievements, making the talk all about you rather than an idea others can use. I could tell you to go back to basics and to remember that the purpose of your talk is to gift an idea, not to self-promote, but even then you might miss it. It could be hard to see from the inside. Every leader needs someone she can count on for raw, honest feedback, someone who's not afraid to upset or offend if need be. If you're feeling proud of what you've recently accomplished, it's important to try out your talk on that trusted person and then give them the chance to say, that was great in parts, but honestly, you come over a little full of yourself. Tell a story. Storytelling is so important that the entire next chapter is dedicated to it. But one of its most important functions is to build connection with the audience. We're born to love stories. They are instant generators of interest, empathy, emotion, and intrigue. They can brilliantly establish the context of a talk and make people care about a topic. Powerful stories can appear at any stage of a talk. A great way to open, a great way to illustrate in the middle, and sometimes, though less often, a great way to end. Ernesto Ciroli wanted to give a talk about a better approach to development aid in Africa. If you're going to take on a tough subject like that, it's a very good idea to connect with the audience first. Here's how he did it. Our first project was where we Italians decided to teach Zambian people how to grow food. So we arrived there with Italian seeds in southern Zambia in this absolutely magnificent valley going down to the Zambezi River, and we taught the local people how to grow Italian tomatoes and zucchini, and of course the local people had absolutely no interest in doing that. And we were amazed that the local people in such a fertile valley would not have any agriculture, but instead of asking them how come they were not growing anything, we simply said, thank God we're here, just in the nick of time to save the Zambian people from starvation. And of course, everything in Africa grew beautifully. We had these magnificent tomatoes, and we could not believe, and we were telling the Zambians, look how easy agriculture is. When the tomatoes were nice and ripe and red, overnight some 200 hippos came out from the river, and they ate everything. And we said to the Zambians, my God, the hippos! And the Zambians said, yes. That's why we have no agriculture here. When you can pull together humor, self-deprecation, and insight into a single story, you have yourself a winning start. The stories that can generate the best connection are stories about you personally or about people close to you. Tales of failure, awkwardness, misfortune, danger, or disaster told authentically are often the moment when listeners shift from plain vanilla interest to deep engagement. They have started to share some of your emotions. They have started to care about you. They have started to like you. But be careful. Some stories can come over as boastful or emotionally manipulative. When you explain the amazing way you turned a problem into a thrilling success, far from connecting, you may actually turn people off. When you pull the photograph of your eldest son from your jacket pocket right at the end of your talk, declare that he's been diagnosed with a terminal illness, and say that your talk is devoted to him, you may make your audience more uncomfortable than sympathetic. The guideline here is just to be authentic. Is that the real you telling this story? A good test is to imagine whether you would tell this story to a group of old friends, and if so, how? Friends are good detectors of the inauthentic. And so are audiences. Be real, and you won't go too far wrong. And that advice applies to this entire chapter on connection. I've sometimes described these suggestions as tools or techniques. It's important they don't come over that way. They need to be part of an authentic desire to connect. You're a human. Your listeners are humans. Think of them as friends. And just reach out. I can't end this chapter without lamenting the biggest killer of connection. Tribal thinking. Whether in politics, religion, or race, people who are part of a community that has rejected wholesale the ideas you want to articulate are, to say the least, a challenging audience. Did my reference above to Tony Blair make you angry at me? After years in power, and especially because of his support for the war in Iraq, he became hated by some, to the point where just mentioning his name raised their stress levels. For them,